Hey, this is Michael Wilson of Queensryche, and you're listening to Focus on Metal.
Hey, metal lads, Scott Thompson here, welcoming you to episode 590 of that which we call Focus on Metal. So yeah, I know it's been a couple weeks since we popped an episode out to your little metal ear holes, but this week, got a great guest for you, and that is one of our frequent contributors, Brian Heaton, who, if you remember correctly, Brian is one of the co-authors of Building an Empire, the story of Queensryche. And now Brian has come out with his own book, which is called Roads to Madness, the touring history of Queensryche, 1981 to 1997. So happy to get Brian on the show. Actually, before the book even comes out, to talk all about it, he did provide me a few weeks back with a pre-release PDF copy of the book, so I was able to read through that. Very excited about it because I did pre-order my own hardcover version of it the day that it was announced that it was going to be available. That was months ago. And if this sounds like something that you might want to have, you know, you're a Queensryche fan or just a fan of, you know, 80s music or whatever, and you're like, you know what? I'm already sold. I'd love to have the touring history of Queensryche. You could go up to NW Metalworks Music and pre-order it. But Brian has done you a solid and created a link that's probably way easier to remember. And that is if you go to roadstomadness.com. And that will just link you right over to NW Metalworks Music and the pre-order page for the multiple versions of Roads to Madness. And also, when I do put up the show notes for this episode up on focusonmetalpod.com, I'll put the link that will bring you right there as well. So as I alluded to before, Brian has been a long time in the background, contributed to the show, always been trying to push him to get some availability to kind of come into the foreground and do some stuff as well. But obviously, having written or co-written a couple books in the last few years, and when you hear all the effort that he put into doing Roads to Madness and the effort that it took, you could see why he wasn't really available to be in the foreground here on Focus on Metal. However, he has provided us with a lot of other opportunities. And so when you go back and you listen to all the great stuff we did with Jason Slater, that was all made possible by Brian, and a lot of the Queensryche stuff that we've had in the past has been enabled by Brian behind the scenes, hooking us up with people that he knows within that orbit and getting them on the show. And hopefully he'll be able to continue in that capacity for us for a long time to come. But again, and I even tell him in the interview too, love to have you come on and be more of somebody, you know, I've always considered him to kind of be a third co-host, and really kind of would love him to be more active in the show. But great interview this week with Brian as he goes into everything about, you know, why he did this book, how he did this book, how it's intended to be used. A lot of good discussion just about that era and the current era. So some other good kind of Queensryche rabbit hole we go down as well, because why the hell not? But good stuff. I would say that you are in store for well over an hour of great discussion with Brian this week on this episode. So like I said, been a few weeks. We're going to rectify that right now as we kick into my discussion with author and super contributor, Brian Heaton.
All right, Focus on Metalers. Finally, at long last, I get to talk with who I've considered for several years now, one of the unofficial co-hosts of Focus on Metal, Brian Heaton. How you doing, Brian?
Good, Scott. How are you, man? It's good to talk to you again.
You too. So it's awesome to have you back on the show. And, you know, I think people who have been longtime listeners probably don't realize how much that you've been involved in helping us with getting a lot of guests and getting certain people to trust us and talk to us. And so I would say that a crap load of our prior Queensryche history content is accredited to your work behind the scenes and making it happen. So I want to personally thank you for that, because we've been able to have access to some incredible guests, and people have been really open and had some great stories. So, you know, again, thank you for all of that you've done in the past, and hopefully, you know, more of it in the future.
Yeah, you're absolutely welcome. And it's been my pleasure to help out, and I love the show, and anything I can do to support you and Richie, I'm happy to do.
Awesome. Thank you. So of course we're returning the favor a bit tonight, and, in sort of a way, because I honestly, you know, having the early access to read the new book, is I am more than happy to get the word out for this. And of course, what I'm talking about is the book that'll be coming out called Roads to Madness, which is a touring history of Queensryche I think 1981 and 1997, correct?
That's right.
Awesome. And it was interesting. There was something that when I was reading the book, and I went back the other day to review something after I had seen Queensryche over the weekend, and I noticed the page count, and I was actually amazed that there's and I don't notice it when I'm looking at the PDF preview, but I went back and I looked at Building Empires, and I realized that the page count for Roads to Madness is about 100 pages more than the history of Queensryche that you guys wrote a couple years ago.
Yeah, we didn't really plan it this way. It just we got to the point with this book when the idea came up about making sure that we cover all the band's major tours. And by the time we got finished with it, we were sitting at 560 some odd pages. The other thing that people might be surprised to know is this is a bigger format book. So the pages are 8.5 by 11, like a regular sheet of paper. It's not the novel size that everybody's used to, like the Building an Empire book that we wrote a few years back. This is actually much bigger. It's meant as a coffee table book. And we were surprised as anybody when we got finished. We were sitting at, you know, almost 600 pages. It was crazy. It's been a monster.
Like I said, I was just really surprised. I'm like, I go in and I'm like, holy crap. Because, you know, when you're looking at it physically, you're thinking, wow, this is, you know, this is such a big book. And now I'm like, knowing this is going to be a coffee table book from emails with you before and stuff. And I'm like, wow, this is going to be just incredible to actually finally get this in my hands. And it was funny because at the same time that I pre-ordered this book, I had also pre-ordered the Metal Church book. And then
yes,
we had emailed back and forth a little bit. And then I see an envelope come in from NW Metalworks. And I was like, psych, it's the Queensryche book. Totally like spacing that I had ordered the Metal Church book. So then I like, oh, I'm like, oh, it's the Metal Church book. Damn it. But I'm so looking forward to this, because I've already started, like I did after seeing Queensryche this weekend, which is just ironic that we're talking today, and going back and reviewing some of the stuff that was in this book on the Warning Tour, because the current tour they're out doing is the Origins Tour, where they're doing the EP in full and they're doing the Warning in full. And I had some questions, and I was like, I'm going to go back and then when I went back, because remember when I first read this, I think 2 nights, maybe 3 nights, I just read through the entire book cover to cover. And then you were like, well, you know, it is like a coffee table book. It's more of a pick it up, leaf through it, look for something, put it down. It's not like a cover to cover read. You know, that wasn't the ultimate intention. And now here I am now with like, oh, my little reference. I'm going to go back and look at it. So now I'm finally using the book kind of the way you intended it.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. Yeah. That's exactly how a person is supposed to really use the book. It was the concept behind it was I had all this information that we didn't put into Building an Empire, the biography on the band. I had all this information on their live shows over the years. And the thought was, well, we're all getting older. We've seen this band in its original form way back in the day. If we're popping a show on YouTube and kicking back and watching something over the weekend, maybe we put on Operation Live Crime from back in the day. If it jogs memories and that whole nostalgic feeling, let me pick this up. I remember I went to three or four different shows back in the day. Let me pick this book up and look at them and see what's there. And then you crack open the book and you say, hey, I went to the show Uniondale, Long Island, New York, back in 1991. What did they play? And boom, there's the set list. And hey, look at that. There's backstage passes. Hey, wait a minute. There's all of Jeff Tate's stage banter from this gig. Like, this is exactly what he said. And it's just, I did this for a couple of gigs as I was formulating the idea for the book. And I said, I have to put something together like this. And originally, believe it or not, it was just going to be a website. I thought I would reface my website and put all this information, revitalize the information and put it back online. And I realized that my web skills are out of date by about 20 years. And I figured a book is probably the better move for me.
Man's got to know his limitations.
And that's when I got my buddy Brian Narron involved, who's more of a visual person. And he had this great idea of like, well, you want to do the book, let's make this a piece of memorabilia that people can not only get all the information, but then we'll put in all the audience photos and then professional photos as well and make it this big monster of a book that, you know, eventually within a few weeks you'll have in your hands.
Yeah. And again, you guys did an incredible job on this. And besides the set list, too, you have other things in there like, if a particular show was bootlegged, you know, what that bootleg is called, or you'll have notes about some of the opening bands, or it might even be a, hey, this is the one time they played this song this way. And so a lot of other things too, which it might even be that you didn't know that was special at the show you were at until you read this and go, oh, that's pretty cool. And I was also thinking afterwards too, that, you know, having done a lot of talks with Martin Popoff, and having had some involvement with some of his books where he's tried to pull in like fan memories or memorabilia pictures and all that. And he's had kind of limited response considering, you know, the number of books that Martin's put out and the audience he has. And then I look at this and I see, like you mentioned, the fan photos and stuff, the amount of stuff that was contributed here with T-shirts and tickets and passes and show photos, all kinds of stuff. It makes it like just a really incredible read and not just this like stiff page after page of text.
Thanks for saying that, Scott. Really, that's exactly the vibe that Brian Narron and I want to get across with this. It's completely from the fan perspective, from the audience perspective. There's another book, which I don't mind throwing out there, from the fabulous photographer Ross Halfen, just published a book on his Queensryche imagery over the years. And that has anecdotes from the actual band in it. And I knew that was coming out, but this book is completely different in that it looks at it from our eyes. Right. We're standing back and watching the band and remembering all this stuff. And that's the perspective of this particular book. So I really appreciate what you caught, all the little nuances about the detail that was added in. Those were all factoids that, to be honest with you, I had been collecting since 93, 94, 95, little things I pull out of magazines, all the 350 bootlegs that I collected, or maybe it's probably even closer to 500 that I collected over the years. I listened back and transcribed all of that stuff, meaning transcribed like the stage banter from Jeff Tate. I kind of went through and just grabbed every piece of information that I could find and then looked back at, okay, well, when was the first time they played this? When was the last time they played this? It was a big, I would say it was probably about a 3-year project of actually pulling the information and comparing it and putting together the book. But the main research from it, I've been doing it for years, probably since 95 or so, 96, of putting together all those dates. Nothing in that book, tour date-wise, was sourced from things like setlist.fm. Hmm. It was all independently researched and verified using, you know, the band's own tour books and dates and their tour itineraries, all the dates that I had collected, the bands that they opened for, all their historic data. It was really important to me because setlist.fm is a great resource. And a lot of people use that to find information about concerts. Mm. It's also very wrong about the shows that happened in the 80s and the 90s. And for Queensryche, I wanted to make sure the most accurate stuff was in there.
Yeah, and setlists.fm, it's very dry, too. It's just like, here's what they played. Here's the opening band. And then you get kind of the pictographs of like percentage off of each album and things like that, where, you know, when you read this, and it's also kind of, you know, when we founded this show, the initial thing that Dari and I were thinking about was that it was this, you know, we're getting older. You don't get to hang out with the same friends that you used to listen to music with or go see music with. You miss that conversational aspect, those kind of snippets of the way music fans talk and all of that. And when I read this, it's almost like when you're back and you're talking with your friends about the show, or when you're at a show these days and you meet somebody else who's standing in line with you, and the way you remember little snippets of the last show. And that's what this book reminds me of when you go through it.
Thanks. Yeah, that's exactly what I tried to put together, that vibe, that nostalgic feeling of, hey, I remember Jeff Tate back in 1991, and he hit this note that was incredible. I wanted to find those things and put them in there to give the book definitely more life, more, I guess you would say it's a more interactive approach to the band's history, their life history, than anything else that you could find. Something that tweaked the nostalgic, you know, aspect of what people are interested in music, and then learn a little bit something from the reference material that's in there as well. Visually and words-wise, put them together, and then give somebody a keepsake, as my good buddy Brian Narum would call it, this piece of memorabilia you can go back to time and time again. And I'm glad that you've been enjoying it, because it was a hell of a lot of fun to put together, and I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, it was even, you know, after that first pass that I went through, I even went back, and, you know, I've got that frame thing of some of the backstage passes and stuff from the band, and it was like, I don't remember what the hell they played on that show. Wait a minute, let me go back. And it was just really nice to go back here and be like, oh, yeah. So, I think it's just a fantastic way to do it. You know, this, I think other people have done things that are like this, but I don't think it has all of the very like fan centric part of it. It's more of the, you know, the journalistic part of it instead. And I think that's what makes this different, is all the other stuff that usually when you're a music fan, you know, we like our ticket stubs. We like our t-shirts. You know, I mean, after the first book, you know, I went back through my t-shirts and I found that Rage to Order shirt that I had like in the back of my mind, I seemed to remember I had it, but I couldn't remember where the hell it was. And after doing that, I had to go back and find it. Those things get triggered by books like this.
Well, I appreciate that. And I know one of the things that a couple of the books that really inspired this project was, it's called Reckless Road, The Making of Appetite for Destruction, by Mark Cantor, who was a best friends with Slash growing up in LA. And I picked up that book when it first came out. It's got to be 15 years ago now. And I was blown away. And I just kind of filed that style of book where Mark Cantor was a photographer and a really great one. And he captured every show GNR played from the moment they were put together as a band until I think the end of the Appetite tour that he attended. But a lot of that local granular stuff, the things that Axel said from the stage, the different types of shirts and the different types of flyers that the band had put together. And that really resonated with me as a big fan of that era of Guns N' Roses. And that was partially the model that really drove this. It's like, well, the original lineup of Queensryche is my favorite band of all time. There's nobody that has this kind of material, probably except for me, that could put it together, both from a journalistic perspective, because of my background as a writer, and just a historian's perspective. Mm-hmm. So I figured if nobody else had done it, let's give it a crack and, you know, give it a try and see what happens. And it came out just the way I was hoping it would. So
yeah, and what's interesting too is I think to me at least, one of the other things that makes this kind of a more personal and more like fan-centric book is that you didn't go down the road of this was the attendance and comparing the attendance of this tour versus the attendance of the tour prior. And like you didn't go down the statistical tour road, which starts to make it an impersonal type of writing. And I think that missing makes this a better book.
I appreciate that comment because that was something that I hemmed and hawed over quite a bit in the beginning. The reason why actually some of that material, the attendance numbers and such aren't in there is because I couldn't verify some of that data that I had. I couldn't get a lot of it. You know, I got some of it from their headline shows in the, you know, for the Building Empires tour and all that kind of stuff. But it was really difficult if I went further back in the 80s. And at some point I had filled in a couple of them. Mm-hmm. But for that same reason was the reason why I said, you know what, I'm not going to have it all. And it makes it really stiff. So let's take this out. And that's where the stage banter idea was born. Mm-hmm. It was like, well, how do I fill some of the gaps that I have on here? Oh, wait a minute. I've got 500 bootlegs I can transcribe. Let me grab what everybody from the stage has said and put that together. And I hadn't seen that in a book before. At least none of the bands that I've seen that have done tour history books, Kiss, Rush. Rush was another big one. They have that great book of theirs, which is Wandering the Face of the Earth, mm-hmm. which is their official touring history. That was a behemoth. And even then, you didn't have any of Getty's stage banter really in there. I mean, snippets of it here and there. But I really wanted to make an emphasis that when you open that book and you look at a show, it's like I'm reliving it again. Like, go put on that show from the Boston Garden back in 1991, sit back, and then you can literally watch the show and read verbatim what Tate's saying. Mm-hmm. Its interactivity was really a big deal. And I hope I really captured a lot of that. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, I think you did. I like the way that it was all put together. And yeah, I think there was, I want to say it was might have been an Iron Maiden touring thing I had read. And it was more of, you know, this tour had this many dates versus the last tour had, you know, and you just kind of, you'd zone out on it. I think, too, that, you know, when you start doing the stage banner, well, you can't really do it for Kiss because Paul says the same stuff every single night. But, you know, it's like people and then something. But, you know, with Jeff, you kind of get these things where he's ad-libbing and he's winging things and you get a lot of that. And it's also interesting with the people that contributed as well of all the kind of different viewpoints of what people saw on the show and what was important about the band to not just you, but other people that were going back and giving their memories of it as well. So you get a lot of nice little different viewpoints as well that, again, make it like that more of a fan-centric, something you can pick up, read a little bit, and put down.
But the interesting thing about the stage banter was that I was concerned at first that Jeff was going to repeat himself too much because I've been a big collector of their bootlegs since 94, 95, and I remember Jeff repeating himself just from back in the day when I first collected all these live shows. And when I went back and I listened to all of them and I started transcribing, the spots in the show, obviously, where he starts saying things is always identical. Mm-hmm. But there are really small differences in way more of the shows than I thought. And those are the ones that I really captured. I didn't capture the stage banter for every show that's in the book, but I did grab a lot of them that were different, and I put those in so that people could really, it's that personal touch, right?
Yep.
I remember Jeff saying exactly this. Well, one of my favorites was back in, I think it was the Here and the Now Frontier Tour, the last tour, and Queensrÿche had done this before. They stopped Breaking the Silence, and the crowd would sing a line of Breaking the Silence. Well, every now and then, Jeff would say something after the audience finishes the line and the band is completely quiet. One of it was, yeah, we got some loud motherfuckers here in New York. And I remember that from 97, like it was yesterday. Mm. And when I revisited on the bootleg, I'm like, shit, he did say that. And he didn't always say that with all the different other shows. He did it here and there. Yeah. So there was a lot of minute differences that, to me, made it more of a personal thing. And that's what I'm hoping, and I'm glad that you feel that way, because that's what I'm hoping for. And, you know, the attendees and all the different attendees at the shows, there's so many great perspectives in there. That was the most fun for me, to be honest, as the writer of the book, is capturing all that commentary from friends of mine, people who had submitted things to me for my old websites over the years, and pulling that stuff and revisiting that. There's stuff from the Warning Tour when Queensryche was headlining these tiny little, like, apartment size venues where, you know, the stage is set so, it's stage is set high and the ceiling is low, and it's like they're playing in your living room, and people had commented about some of that. Mm. That's awesome. And then you get some of the later shows where Queensryche, a much bigger band, and you hear people in the audience, and I tried to include some of this too, where people had never seen Queensryche before. All they thought about was, like, they thought they were, you know, Silent Lucidity. That was the only thing that they knew. And you can hear people in the crowd going, "What the fuck is this?" I thought that was hysterical. And so I tried to include some of those little comments in there as editor's notes. This is what was said during the song break, blah, 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 blah. Just to kind of bring that personal touch back into things.
Yeah, that was part of the fun of going to the show this weekend with that being the Origins tour, is that just to be in a big room like that and have a huge percentage of the audience know every single damn song. And it's not like, you know, the Warning was full of hits, and it's not like the, you know, the EP was full of hits, but it was, you know, everybody was like fully engaged in these songs, and, you know, playing the EP front to back, playing the Warning front to back. And it was great. And it really psyched me up as well to even, you know, be able to talk to you about the book this week. And, you know, you think back to when going to one of the original Warning Tour or one of the original Raid shows, or, and again, it was all people that knew what was on the album. We didn't know what was on the radio. So to be able to see this, see what they played, get kind of the interaction and viewpoints and all that, it also brings you back to what you were doing back in, you know, 81, 82, 83, and that, because that was a damn long time ago.
One of the cooler perspectives I had, and to touch a little bit about how the book can be read too, it can be read the ways that you both did it. You can read it cover to cover because there's history essays that precede every tour. Mm. So what I tried to do was give people an overview of how the tours started and how they finished before you go into the list of dates and all the pictures and the memorabilia and all that kind of stuff, so that people could actually read it just like you did it first, cover to cover, and get that background. And then you can go ahead and look at it as more of a research guide after that and look at specific shows. But as I was writing all those tour histories and I was trying to flesh out the different perspectives of seeing Queensryche in those different eras, I reached out to quite a few different people, not just fans. I also reached out to some of the band's contemporaries. And one of the most memorable interactions for me was getting a few things from Michael Kiska of Helloween, who rejoined the band several years ago now, but rejoined the band. And Michael was in the audience in Germany on the Warning Tour watching Queensryche open for, I believe it was Dio. And what he says in the book about what he saw in the audience as a young singer starting out and what he got from Queensryche and how they appealed to him and how he immediately went out and bought the Warning and the EP. Those are really cool moments that it's just, again, that fan perspective. You got a guy that's been now a legendary singer. I mean, he's been singing now for 40 some odd years. And to get his perspective on, this is the first time I heard Jeff Tate in Queensryche, and I was blown away, and it made me become a fan. And it's, you know, it was part of the influence on his singing to become a singer was what he saw that particular night. That was cool. Focus. Ah!
Yeah, it was when I read that too. I was like, wait a minute, did that just say Michael Kiske? Like, wow, that is pretty cool.
Yeah, he was really, really nice, and I only we exchanged emails back and forth a couple times, and I really appreciate him taking a little bit of time to give me some of his memories. I really felt it added some great color for the book.
Yeah, and I do like, and I'm glad you mentioned it too, is that to have those little kind of essays that are sprinkled throughout the book, it's really good too, because what that reminded me of was, you know, if you've got like a bunch of old Kerrang magazines or something like that, and you just pick one up and you read like this article just out of the blue and go, oh yeah, let me reread this again. Oh yeah, that's pretty cool. So to have a lot of these little ones, like one of the ones is that you have is with David Morris, I think he was like the original road crew guy, right? And to get like his memories and kind of how it was in the beginning and all of that, that was like, that's a great thing to just go back and just reread again. And just to have those sprinkled throughout there, you know, if you do the thing I did initially with the cover to cover, it kind of, it's almost like a palate cleanser, the way you laid it out. And then you get this frame of like, okay, where they're at. And then you dive into that next phase as well.
Thanks. That's exactly it. Davey Morris is wonderful. He was the band's first crew member. He was friends with, you know, DeGarmo and Wilton and all of them. Mm. And as folks will read, and as you've already read, he explains how he gets connected. And he was their first roadie and their only roadie for most of the EP tour before they started hiring more people on. Mm. And some of the stories that go along with that, I'm not going to spoil all of them, but there's some really cool stories about Jeff's early struggles as a singer, trying to figure out how to hit certain notes and different things and what the band had to do, and some of the challenges he had in Japan and things that surprised him. He was great to talk to, wonderful guy. And some of these stories he's told in the past for years, but they never appeared in print before now. Hmm. So people are going to get to see them and see them and read about them for the first time. Those tour history essays, they work exactly how you described. It's the old journalist in me. I sat back and was like, well, every one of these album tour cycles, the band was in a different stage. And I felt it was really important to set that stage so that people knew what they were about to read, why some tours were longer than others, why the band was playing certain things and opening for particular bands at particular junctures. I just felt this context was needed to make it more than just this reference guide. You want this thing to be something that's its primary use. Look up these shows, but you want it also to read like articles. You want each chapter to appear like I'm reading an article about the Rage for Order tour, and here's everything that happened on the Rage for Order tour summarized. And now I can dig in after I read that essay and look up specific instances that are talked about in those essays. So I appreciate you saying that, because that's exactly how I was hoping it would be. More of a palate cleanser. I know about this particular tour. I can dial in and get down in the weeds if I want, or I can move forward and go to the next tour and read that overview and get what I need.
Yeah, and you know, and I think it's important too to do that framing without making this, you know, a reprise of the prior book, but still getting a kind of the frame of where they are, because Queensryche is definitely a band that did advance and change and morph from album to album. And they had different mindsets, and they had different, you know, whether they had internal influencers as they start to go on later with like Empire, you start to get more label influences telling them that they need to do things. So you get this kind of brief framing, but then you allow the tour to speak for kind of what the resultant of all of that is, rather than let's just get into a history lesson again.
And that breathing and that openness and letting people kind of understand what's going on in the context, it's just really important for a band like Queensryche. As you said, they change from record to record. They were very unlike many bands of the time. I mean, the greatness that is AC/DC, let's admit it, even the biggest AC/DC fan is going to say, all right, a lot of these records are very samey, but they're very successful and they're very good. Queensryche was a different beast. In some ways, they reinvented the band on every release. They really did, in their original form. Mm-hmm. And that just sets up so many different quote unquote storylines, that's really important to kind of delve into and where they were at those turning points of those, each of those album cycles in their careers. Going from the challenges they had with Rage for Order and marketing Rage for Order and all that, to go into a concept record about Mindcrime. And, you know, some people might be surprised. Mindcrime didn't do well until they really heavily toured it and launched a video for it.
Right.
And then people got it and it took off. And then seeing the change in their audience and seeing people come in for the very first time that maybe just, dismissed them. I saw that video for Gonna Get Close to You on MTV. They look like a bunch of posers. I'm not going to listen to them. And they're like, oh, holy shit, this Eyes of a Stranger, this blew me away. And seeing the differences in the audience reaction, that was really cool.
Yeah, they have a lot of influences. In an odd way, that kind of there's a timeline or kind of influence line that's almost very similar to Pearl Jam, where you get that, you know, you get the Queensryche EP where essentially you've got music written and they eventually convince Jeff to come in. And so he's applying stuff to music that he essentially wasn't really involved with. And you get the EP, which I remember buying that thing before I had even heard of the band. And I was blown away. But then you get the album that, you know, 10, which is a very similar thing. You get this band that had all this music together. And, you know, then they pull in their singer and he kind of applies his thing to it. You get this thing that's like this breakout album for them. But then after that, now you've got this band that's together and there's a jockeying for influence and you see how like their albums have played out. So you look at the latest and you compare that to 10 and, you know, Dark Matter does not really compare to, you know, is not the same group as 10. And then you look at Queensryche and you look at, you know, what they had with the EP versus what they had, you know, for the last album where Jeff was involved. And again, it's a very different band. And as those characters change, I think all that changes. And you see some of that too within the sets too, where it's like, no, we don't want to play that anymore. We want to play this. And so, I think this is a constantly evolving band where AC/DC, yeah, you've got this thing where when you've got the brothers young kind of producing the brothers young, you get this kind of a thing where they're, you know, everything that's recorded in the Albert studios sounds very similar. Then you kind of have the more commercial stuff comes in, you get a little bit of sonic change, but kind of the musical ethos remains the same. It works for them. And I am a huge AC/DC fan, but I also love the fact that with Queensryche, you never knew what you were going to get. Granted, a few albums, I will confess, it was kind of like, you know, American Soldier, I couldn't really get into. But a lot of the earlier ones, I love the evolution that was happening. And even when they started to not be as heavy, I didn't really miss it because there was a lot of other stuff going on.
There was this interesting thing with the original band that even though each album shifted from one style to the next, there was this constant undercurrent of who they were. Still, I call it the sonic hallmarks of the band. You hear it through every release of the original band. Even a record like Here in the Now Frontier, you pick that up, and you know, obviously, even though we'd have to ask Chris to really know if this is true or not. It sounds like it's very influenced. Like he was listening to Soundgarden. Soundgarden's Down on the Upside quite a bit. If you compare those two records, sonically, you hear some similarities in it. But what I really love about Queensryche is you could put on The Warning, and then you can put on Here in the Now Frontier, and you're going to hear some of those same sonic hallmarks. The music is totally different. You're not playing metal anymore. You're playing more of a heavy rock, kind of grungy, different type of production. You're doing something completely different, but you hear the interesting little guitar hallmarks of the band. You have the way Jeff phrases things, that's always a constant, but the way Scott's playing, those kind of things remain very constant, yet the songs and the style changes. To me, I've always found that really exciting to listen to. It's why it doesn't bore me to still listen to that original band's catalog all these years later, because I always feel like I'm listening to, I guess, a songwriting evolution I guess most of that is probably Chris, but I'm hearing that evolution. And to me, it's still exciting and it's still fresh to this day. And that's why, you know, Queensryche's music still is inspiring to write books like this one. And you mentioned earlier the biography that James Beach and Brian Aaron and myself wrote a few years back. And Roads to Madness is just an extension of that love of all that music back in the day.
Yeah, just an awesome, awesome job. When you start to get into kind of the latter tours, was it harder to track down stuff for that stuff where you had some smaller dates and was there like less availability for information on those?
No, it was actually the opposite.
Hmm.
Yeah. The later tours, the Promised Land tour in 95 and then 94, 95, and then here in the Now Frontier in 1997, they had big budgets behind them. So there was a lot of material that I had collected over the years. And for me, the Empire, well, mostly Mindcrime through Here in the Now Frontier, as a collector, I had collected all this stuff. But the harder points for me were going back. And I had a lot of material from the band, tour dates and all this other stuff. Verifying information was actually harder going back into the 80s than it was for those mid-90s eras of the band. It was actually pretty easy for that. The Rage for Order tour was probably the most difficult to verify everything, just because the band was in between management.
Okay.
While that tour launched, they had one set of managers. They were their first managers, and then they were gone. And then the band continued and made decisions and was testing out some other things. And that made it difficult. I'll give a great example. Back in November of 86, Queensryche had a feeling they weren't going to be able to get to Europe and they really wanted to get back to Europe. So they had an opportunity to go open for Bon Jovi. Mm. And Bon Jovi was supporting Slippery When Wet. Well, there was this whole slate of dates that Queensryche opened for Bon Jovi, but I discovered in the middle of my research, I'm like, wait a minute, Queensryche didn't open this section of these dates in November. That was FM, the band FM, if you remember them.
Yep.
And I had to go back and look at everything, compare things to finally come up with the listing of dates and memorabilia. And that was a big thing. There was some memorabilia, some tickets printed for shows Queensryche planned to play as a headliner that they had canceled in 86 to take the tour with Bon Jovi. So figuring out what did they play and what they did not play, that actually was more difficult than verifying the stuff when they were a bigger band and playing, you know, amphitheaters like they did on Promised Land and Here in the Now Frontier. Those were easy and getting a lot of that information because the internet had been born by then and people were posting stuff and doing things. So a lot of that information was easily obtainable if I didn't already have it.
Okay. Yeah. I just didn't know if, you know, when you start to get to the latter tours that, you know, there weren't as many bootlegs available and, you know, because when usually when your bands are kind of in that earlier one, you know, it's people that go that really want to see them. And a lot of times some of these venues, like obviously something like Empire, they're, you know, they're watching everybody coming in, they're screening all that. But like these earlier things where they're playing clubs and stuff, it's a lot easier to slip things in for recording and stuff. And so I thought maybe you had more references for the former gigs, but that's interesting.
Well, you know, I mean, that's a good point because maybe I misunderstood your question a little bit. There definitely were less shows on the Here and the Now Frontier tour. That was a very small tour. Mm. But the amount of people that were bootlegging and recording Queensryche at these gigs, it did slow down. I mean, Empire and Mindcrime was the pinnacle, right? I have more shows and more collection from those two tours than anything, just because everybody was in there recording. But as it got into Promised Land and then especially Here in the Now Frontier, there are less shows just because they played less shows. But that was one of the beautiful things about Queensryche. Even in that time frame, in the mid to late 90s, they were still really popular for people who take bootlegs. I remember walking into the first bootleg recording I had ever received was a show called Saints and Sinners, and it was May 24th, 1995 at the Shark Tank, which is the San Jose Arena in San Jose, California. A buddy of mine gave it to me as a gift, and that started my my whole collecting of Queensryche shows and having to go back into the, you know, and collect everything from back in the day, from the 80s and the earlier tours. But what I'm trying to get at is that when I would go to record stores that would still carry these bootlegs, I would talk to the record store owners and they would say, you know, the music might not be as popular, but Queensryche, I'm still getting in stuff from people who are recording Queensryche. And that's how it was easy for me to build my collection, just on stuff that was silver pressed from back in the day. And then obviously once Queensryche's original lineup broke apart and the internet got bigger, then it was much easier to tape trade with people and get a whole bunch of different shows. So a little bit of both, Scott. It was a little bit harder, but not as hard as you think for the later tours.
What about Japan? I know at one point, late 80s, I was working with this kid who he lived in Japan for a while. His dad was stationed over there. And this kid had the most freaking amazing collection of bootleg Japan shows that I'd ever seen in my life. And he was like, oh yeah, he's like, it's easy. Like everybody's got them. And I was blown away, one with the quality, but just the sheer amount of stuff that he had of shows from Japan.
Yeah. The Japan shows that Queensryche did were always highly bootlegged. I know that the warning tour that they did, obviously they recorded some of that shows for Live in Tokyo, but that whole tour, there's a ton of bootlegs out there. There's a ton from my personal favorite tour that Queensryche ever did was the headlining dates in 1989 for the Operation Mindcrime album. And they did a whole, I want to say off the top of my head, it was probably 7 or 8 dates in Japan in May of 1989. All of those are bootlegged. I think every show was recorded. Mm. Same thing with when they went there on Empire and Promised Land. It just, the Japanese collectors and the tapers there, they really loved the band. And it was easy to obtain those when I was younger and I was collecting things and exchanging things back and forth with people. The Japanese shows were really easily attainable. And even to this day, you know, you even go on to Amazon in Japan and they've got all these radio broadcasts. And where are they all? From Japan.
Yeah, that's, I see a lot of that now is the radio broadcast being pressed. There's been a couple, even I had to laugh because, you know, I was actually an FM DJ for a while. And so we would get these, you know, like the King Biscuit Flower Hour or whatever, and it just came on vinyl. Yeah. And you just put it on and you talked to the spots and all that. And there's been a few that I've seen listed. And it's been like, son of a bitch, that's actually the same thing I've got sitting over my collection. That's actually it's just the radio show again. So it's, I think they seem to be becoming popular again. Of people, like even multiple different, you know, like the same show with multiple titles as well, which is a little ridiculous. But yeah, they'll seem to be a real popular bootleg.
Yeah, and it's funny you mention that because I'm sitting here in my office here at home and I have a stack of 3 or 4 of these things. Skid Row Live in Japan 95, Skid Row Live in Japan 92, Bon Jovi Live in Yokohama 96, and then Winger Live in Tokyo 1991. So all that stuff, for some reason, there's been a big trend. And I have a bunch of stuff from Dio and a few other bands from there, too. I don't know what's going on over there, but it's definitely become more accessible over the years.
And, of course, you answered my question I was going to ask, which was overall what was your favorite tour. So,
God, that tour was amazing, Scott. That May 1989 run in Japan, and then they played some dates over, Queensryche played some dates over in the western part of the U.S. where I live now. They did a run of shows there in Southern California. The set list was great because if you're a metal fan, and I'm really, my favorite era of the band are their metal years. Mm-hmm. You know, the EP through Mindcrime is my favorite era of the band. Those Mindcrime headline shows, all the stuff from Rage, all the stuff from The Warning, most of Mindcrime, it didn't get any better than that. And you could tell the excitement in the band. I mean, you put on one of those bootlegs, and when they're playing, you know, their 50th show opening from Metallica in January 1989, they're dialed in, they sound amazing, but there's so much more character in the shows that they played in Japan and in California in May 1989. The set list obviously was, you know, they're playing songs that they hadn't played in a while and getting to do things, and it's their own show. But the energy was just off the charts. It was my favorite tour that they ever did. I wish I could have seen it live, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I just, as you're talking to, I scroll back to May 89, and just, it's like, yeah, that's a incredible, incredible set list. And, yeah, those had...
It doesn't get much better than that if you're a metal fan. It really doesn't.
Well, yeah, and you know, that was the thing, too, that, you know, when Todd joined the band and they went out, one of the first shows I saw when they were back out, what I was so enthusiastic about was that they were reaching back to what Michael wanted to do of getting back to that core metal stuff. And, you know, to have it with, you know, Queen of the Reich opening, and just, it was stuff off Rage. It was stuff off Warning. It was stuff off Mind Crime. And it was, oh crap, I've missed this so much, to have like a set list based around kind of the stuff that was my core of Queensryche fandom. And, you know, I read this and it's like, yeah, that's the set right there.
You know, I have so much respect for the current version of Queensryche and what they're trying to do. They have almost an impossible job. They have the fans that really want to see them play their new material because the new material with Todd is good.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to do that. And then they have so many other people that are like, hey, you got a singer in the band now that really wants to sing the metal stuff. And so they say, okay, let's go ahead and play it. And, you know, the Warning is Todd LaTorre's favorite Queensryche record that he doesn't sing on. And he's been very, you know, very vocal about that. And they do a phenomenal job. And it does bring, I didn't get to see the Origins tour. I just wasn't able to make the night that they had by me. Mm. But, you know, from what I've seen on YouTube and from friends of mine that have gone and checked it out, they sound phenomenal, and they're doing a great job of replicating all that stuff. And those aren't easy records to play, to be really honest. They're not, especially right. The Warning, because that was so much more proggy than that was the Tate influence. But they're so much more proggy than the EP. But they're doing a great job, and yeah, the whole balancing the nostalgia with the need to do new music. The current version of Queensryche really, they do a good job with that as best that they can in this crazy touring environment where everybody's trying to get on the road, and it's hard with everybody who's out there.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a tough decision on their part, too, and it's a very Maiden-esque thing that they're doing, right, where Maiden wants to play new music, and then there's things where they're like, nope, this is going to be a nostalgia tour, okay, and the next one's going to be a new music tour, and so, you know... It's a difficult thing, like you said, right now, too, where bands are trying to catch up on touring revenue and you know, get out there and tour as much as possible. I think it is a tough decision, but obviously, watching, you know, the audience for that show, it was definitely, you know, everybody was like really, really into it. And I think, you know, you've got other bands like, so, you know, I did last week, I also went and saw Judas Priest, and, you know, that one there was kind of the opposite end, where they were playing a couple things off of Invincible Shield, some stuff off Firepower, and then, you know, and then a lot of their classics as well. But, you know, you kind of can go either way. And I have a lot of respect for Queensryche going out and deciding, no, we're going to tour this, doing to do the EP, we're going to do the Warning. And especially with doing the Warning, where you have these very like intertwined solos that, you know, you're trying to do them with live sound in some smaller rooms, and they may not come off sounding as well as they do on the record. But to still, you know, have Mike and Stone go out there and do them, and they still sound great. I hope people didn't expect to have the just like the album version of it. But, it, you know, definitely a challenging album to decide to do, not just in general, but also to have the commitment. No, we're going to do it in order, front to back.
Yeah, and you mentioned Stoney. You know, hats off to Mike Stone. He's coming back into Queens right now the second time.
Mm.
And the first time he got blasted, you know, by a lot of fans.
Yeah.
Because his guitar tone and you know, I mean, people wanted DeGarmo, and DeGarmo was maybe testing the waters back in 2003 and thinking about maybe rejoining the band. And, you know, people ended up getting Stone instead of DeGarmo. There was no way Mike Stone was going to win that. There's no way. But, you know, Mike also did a lot of great things for Queensryche that people don't know about. You know, he co-wrote, you know, Operation Mindcrime 2 with my good buddy, you know, the late Jason Slater. Mm. I mean, that record doesn't get made without Mike Stone. And after Stone leaves and gets replaced, he gets the phone call to come back years later, and he's sitting there and he's doing his best DeGarmo impression, trying to come up with those solos, but also playing them his way.
Yeah.
And a lot of people weren't receptive to that 20 years ago. They really weren't. They gave Stone a lot of grief for that. Kelly Gray too. They gave Kelly Gray a ton of grief.
Yeah.
And now Stone's putting his own personality in these solos too, and you're not really hearing too much complaint.
No, everybody was really, you know, if he came out if he did his spot, he got just as much enthusiastic response as when Whip did his. So it was nice to see the reaction he was getting at the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. That was one of the biggest regrets I had about not making the Origins tour, is I really wanted to see Stoney play this stuff, because he really deserves a hand for the work that he's put in to learn the material and come back out there. I mean, how many guys are going to get canned from a band and then when the band comes calling back to him later, say yes and then come forward and do it? I got a lot of respect for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tough spot. But yeah, he's pulling it off great. And it looks like, at least from, you know, the show I was at, everybody's enjoying it, which is awesome.
Yeah, I'm glad. And that's, you know, that brings up another point about Roads to Badness, Scott, that a couple people are wondering about. The book covers 1981 through 1997. And I keep getting this question here and there about, why did you stop, right? Not only is this book 595 pages, if I were to continue the book, it would have been probably well over 1,200 pages. Had I gone and covered the rest of the band's touring history. Maybe in the future there's another volume. It could be. We'll have to see how well this one does. But the main reason why I stopped it at 1997 was just, that's the era of the band that I think that people remember. It's also the one that's longest ago, which is harder for people to recall some things. I don't know how many shows you've played or how many shows you've been to, but you know, I've been to, you know, 400, 500 concerts in the last 20 years. That's a lot of gigs, and some things go in my one ear and out the other. You know, you forget certain things. So one of the things that Brian Narron and I wanted to do was make sure with this book, we captured enough of the 80s and the 90s so that people will never forget what that original band did. Yeah. And with so many years in the rear view and DeGarmo now having been gone for so long, and Tate's been gone for over a decade now, we really thought it was paramount that a book needed to be created that put that era of the band, the original lineup of the band, in a package so that people will always be able to remember just how impactful Queensryche was in their original lineup. And that's not a slight to the years that followed. You mentioned earlier in our discussion about you weren't the biggest fan of American Soldier and maybe some of the other records that followed the DeGarmo era of the band. I have to say that even though I like them, I definitely think as more years have gone on, what the band used to be, I feel, gets forgotten a little bit in the grand scheme of things, because there was so much that changed in Queensryche after Chris left.
Mm-hmm.
History kind of got rewritten as new albums were being made to help market them. And then you have the lawsuit drama, and now you've got Todd out there fronting Queensryche and Tate doing Queensryche songs, telling stories about things that are way different than what was said back in the 80s. And part of that, I think, is musicians just forgetting, you know, what they've said over time and forgetting how things actually happened. And that's the main reason why Roads to Madness, the touring history of Queensryche, covers those 16 years. They happened so long ago. Let's get this in print so that every fan of the band, that, let's face it, most Queensryche fans started listening to the band's music back in that original form.
Right.
Let's get that put in a box, into a package, and out there so that it's never forgotten.
Yeah. I think the other part of it, too, is that, you know, when you think about it and you're like, okay, so you get into the EP and you're maybe, you know, let's say 14, 15, 16 years old, right? So now you advance, where are you in life 16 years later? And a lot of people, you know, they're into first kids, first house, family. And in the normal scope of most people's lives at that point, you almost go into this little blackout period where you simply don't have the mental bandwidth to take in everything you used to. And so a lot of times it's kind of the new music going into your brain is the thing that suffers for a lot of music fans. So you have this blackout period. So you think about people that were into that. Now you get to that point, they're in that kind of that blackout period. They've got even no idea what was going on with Queensryche in those years. They didn't care. They weren't taking it in. Not that there was anything wrong with the band or the music or anything else. So this is also kind of that perfect chunk, right? It's that the classic band in those classic years and where most of the people were into that band and they were, you know, that kind of the Queensryche get a new album, I'm buying it. As opposed to, you know, wife, kids, family, home kind of gets in the way of being able to do it. So I think it's a perfect cutoff just from that aspect.
That's a really good point. And I'm glad you think that way. I have another friend of mine, this guy, Ray, who is exactly as you described. He was heavily into the band. In fact, he saw Queensryche, I believe it was their first headline show in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he was blown away because he had just heard the band a couple of days before. And he turned around and in his local club, Queensryche was headlining that night. Hmm. And so he ran in there and got a ticket. And one of his memories is in there saying it was like the loudest show that he had ever heard to that point. But he had said to me that after Empire, he didn't have time to really track the band. He was busy. He got married, got a house. So while he was a fan, he never really knew the band's history after that.
Right.
But now after taking a look at what was created with Roads to Madness, this book, he's like, this is the stuff that I missed. He goes, it's great to catch up on that history of one of my favorite bands of a period that I was just too busy to really appreciate.
Yeah.
And you know, that's that. Yeah. So exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah. So I think that just plays into that nice decision you guys made of, you know, this is the chunk of it that we're going to cover. And ultimately, I mean, to make it this kind of nice, good chunk that you want to deliver, I mean, you have to put boundaries somewhere. And ultimately it ends up being a very logical boundary as well, just the way it conveniently works.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun putting together, and who knows? Maybe there'll be a volume two at some point. We'll see.
Yeah, well, you've always got that opportunity, right? So yeah, it's a built-in maybe. So is the book still available as a pre-order up at NW Metalworks, or what's the current story on ordering situation?
Well, you can order it. Northwest Metalworks Music is the publisher that's putting out the book, but their website is spelled a little funky, so I made things a little easy. People can go to roadstomadness.com, and there is a button there that you click on, hyperlink. It'll take you right to the publisher's website. That way people can check out different versions of the book. There's a limited edition hardcover book. There's a standard paperback. And then there's an ebook for folks that just don't want having a physical heavy book around. I really would suggest folks look at one of the printed versions. This is, as we've been talking for the last, you know, 45 minutes or so, this is a reference guide. It's a big book. The PDF is great. It gives you the information on the fly, but it's really meant to hold in your hands. And so all three of those versions are up for pre-order. As we're talking, it's the end of April. The book should be at the publisher probably in the next 2 weeks. So somewhere around the middle of May, we should be shipping off. Middle to end of May, the book should be shipped and people should start getting their copies. And yeah, it's up there right now. You can go to roadstomadness.com.
Awesome. Yeah. And, you know, I'll say, you know, to everyone thinking about, hey, you know, what kind of version do I maybe want to get, that I will say that the hardcover is probably going to be the one if you don't get it, you're going to wish that you got it. Building Empires, I love my hardcover version of it. I think just even the glossy pages, the pictures pop on there. There's, you know, just a lot of great visuals within here as well. And I think that they always get presented better in the hardcover format.
That hardcover is really, I've got a preview of it to just take a look. So when I was approving all the prints, it looks amazing. They both look great, the paperback and the hardcover. The hardcover is limited to 200, and I do know that we're probably at this point we're half sold of it. Mm. So if folks really want to grab a hardcover of this thing, they should probably jump on pretty soon. That will not be reprinted. They cost way too much money
right.
to actually print these days, because as with everything, costs of paper have gone up tremendously. So the paperback will always be available, but the hardcover is strictly limited to 200, and we really enjoyed putting it together, so hopefully people will dig it.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to getting mine in, and yeah, I think I put my order in like the first week it was available, just so I could lock it in. I knew I was good, and part of it too is because I really enjoyed the first book that you guys did on there, and now that I've been able to read the preview that you provided for me, I'm even more looking forward to it, and it's definitely going to be this. Like, now that I've got it in my hands, oh, I'm going to flip it to this page. I'm going to look at this page. And, I'm 100% looking forward to getting this one in.
Well, thanks, Scott. I really appreciate it. And you've been really complimentary towards building an empire, the Queensryche biography. That's all a testament to the writing skill of James Beach and Brian Nairn's vision as well. Those two guys are fun to work with. They've got a really cool company up there in Washington that really focuses on Northwest metal bands, from the obscure that you've never heard of to bands like Queensryche and others. And they do a great job with their stuff. I was happy to contribute to that biography, and I really appreciate the opportunity they've given me to make sure that I get my own book into print, which is Roads to Madness, and we'll see where things go from there. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it, and and then of course selfishly that now maybe when you've done this project and you've got some free time that we can rope you into some Focus on Metal projects. So, you know.
That is on the list, because I have owed you a couple different interviews for years. So why don't we just consider that done and we'll get in touch about that.
That would be great. Like I said, I've always considered you as, this third co-host of the show. So it's, it's always great having you on board, and you've done so much for us in the past. The stuff we had with Jason, I think that ended up being like a couple episodes, was just fantastic. Yeah. We got a lot of good feedback about that. So, I think we all, between, you and Richie, myself, we all kind of love the history aspect and getting that oral history out to folks. Yeah, should be good.
Well, thanks. And I can tell you this much, Jason Slater, as you well know, was one of my closest friends, and I loved him dearly. And I can tell you, he loved you guys. He really enjoyed talking with Richie. He enjoyed talking about his time with Queensryche, and he could have gone on and on and on with Richie for even more hours. So thanks for letting him tell his story. He really appreciated it.
Yeah. I'm glad that all worked out, and sad that he's gone, but glad that at least we've got some history out of him, and anybody can go back and listen as well, which is awesome. It's a sad part of the show, to be honest, because we do have so many people we've had on that aren't with us any longer. But the other side of it is that people can go back and actually listen to these people tell their story, which is great.
Well, Focus on Metal has also been around a while now, and it's always a fun listen. So you and Richie do a great job, and really appreciate it. From a fan's perspective, thanks for keep doing what you guys are doing, because it's always been a fun listen.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it is. It's been long. We get a little burned out, but, when I start doing an episode, I like get the energy back and get back into it. So hopefully we keep doing it. People keep listening.
Sounds good to me.
All right, Brian, I'm going to let you finally get to your evening and your family, and I'm sure your wife's been patiently waiting for you, but I super appreciate being able to talk to you. We can get the word out together about Roads to Madness, and hopefully make this the great success that it deserves to be.
Thanks, Scott. As always, I really appreciate all the support you guys give us, and I'm really looking forward to seeing people's reactions when they finally get a hold of Roads to Madness. It's been a lot of fun putting it together.
Awesome. All right, Brian, you have a good rest of the night.
You too, buddy. Take care.
Okay.
There you go. My chat with Brian Heaton, author of Roads to Madness, The Touring History of Queensryche, 1981 to 1997. And as Brian said, towards the tail end of the interview, that there's not a lot of the hard copies left. So if you want to grab yourself one of those, and I would say that is the one I'm getting, is to head up to either NW Metalworks Music Or even better, go to roadstomadness.com and that will fire you right over to the pre-order page on that other website. Anyways, or as I also mentioned, I will post this as a link in the show notes for this week's show up on focusonmetalpod.com. So big thanks to Brian for taking a lot of time to talk with us. And it's perfect timing as well, because, you know, I'm coming off of seeing Queensryche on the, you know, on the Saturday night. I'm talked to Brian on Tuesday night. I'm still fired up with EP and Warning tunes, and couldn't have timed this better. So that even makes me more psyched to get this out to you guys as we pop out our first episode for May of 2024. And I've got more audio behind this as well. We've got a great interview with Ron Young, and we've got another great interview with Mark Ferrari. Both of those are in the can and edited and hopefully coming out to you as well. It's been incredibly busy for Richie and for myself, and I'm hoping to try to break free a little bit this month and get a few more episodes out this month than last month as we slowly trudge into episode 600, which is, you know, 10 episodes away from this one. Can't believe that that we are getting up to that count. But for this week, that's it. There ain't no more stick a fork in it. This puppy is done. So for Richie, Brian, and myself, and everybody else here at Focus on Metal, have yourselves a great metal week. And until we talk to you again, as always, remember...
Focus on Metal!
Everything else is insignificant.
You're still here? It's over. Go home.